reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on the latest edition of In the Gravel Trap. I'm your host, Joey Barnes. Joined with me, as always, is Josh Farmer of Motorsport Monday and Christopher DeHardy of Motorsport.com. We've got a very special treat for you tonight as we gear up for what's sure to be a fantastic Speed Weeks up in Daytona. And we're going to be joined by Matt Weaver from Popular Speed. He's going to jump in on the show with us and talk a little bit about what he expects for Speed Weeks, maybe what to watch for, and what things are going to happen for the Daytona 500. So we're going to more than likely crown another champion, or B, watch one repeat. So we'll see what happens on that one as he joins us here a little later in the show. We're going to kick off, actually. There was some testing down for IndyCar at NOLA Motorsports Park, and Christopher DeHardy was there. And Chris, by all means, take it away.
All right, so the first bit of good news is that they are starting to build grandstands out there at NOLA Motorsports Park. Given it is New Orleans, we should be experts at building temporary grandstands for Mardi Gras and everything like that. But nothing on the scale of what they're trying to do at NOLA. They had about 14 cars that were testing there. I was able to talk to the Penske drivers. Andretti Autosport only had one driver that went to the media area for the press conference, and that was Carlos Munoz. Bourdais was there. Stefano Colletti was testing for KV. Luca Filippi was there testing. So was Joseph Newgarden. Ed Carpenter was there, but he wasn't driving, of course. Hunter Ray was there. Marco was there as well driving. And it was really an interesting mix. I think Hinchcliffe was also there testing as well. The drivers loved the track. The only thing they didn't like was that they didn't have very many reference points because of the fact that it was so flat. But Montoya was really happy with the track, saying that it was very fast, which it really is. And they were all thrilled to be there. Brian Barnhart was there as well, and he kind of gave the media a very brief introduction to IndyCar racing before any of the drivers spoke to the media.
Oh, geez.
Did they have any... I mean, for the fans, we all know that the aero kits are supposed to be coming out this year. They had no aero kit testing, Chevy or Honda, at this test. Is that correct?
Correct. If there would have been, I would have posted quite a few more pictures on social media.
Well, you had a chance to talk to Simon Pagenaud a little bit, and he was with, I mean, he's newly formed with Team Penske, and, you know, he has, I guess, what you would call an odd relationship with Will Power, best friends that have had their run-ins, and if you're on the racetrack, it's not uncommon that happens. What's the feel you get from him? Did he seem the usual demeanor that we're used to seeing him, like last year with Schmidt-Peterson, or does he kind of have like a calm presence about him?
He was a lot more relaxed because, if you think about it, where Penske is compared to where Schmidt-Peterson is or was, he's in the best team on the grid, or one of the best teams. You can't necessarily say the best because Ganassi's always going to give him a run for their money, but he's in a lot better equipment. No disrespect at all to Schmidt-Peterson, but there's a difference between Schmidt-Peterson's equipment and the kind of work that Roger Penske's team puts into their preparation for any IndyCar race. And they're really our second to none when it comes to being prepared for a race weekend, if you'll excuse, of course, the 1995 Indianapolis 500-mile race. He was really relaxed. It also kind of helps that he didn't have to worry about where he's going to be driving. He didn't have to worry about, you know, how much he's going to have to work to catch up to the big guys, because, well, now he is one of the big guys. And it also kind of helps that he has very, very competent teammates to draw data from for setup work as well, because beforehand he only had a rookie teammate in Mikhail Aloshin, and granted, Aloshin was fast, but looking at one driver's data is a lot different than looking at three drivers' data. So it's going to be interesting to see how Pagano fits in with Power, Castroneves, and Montoya when it comes to learning from their data and how to make the cars even quicker than what they already are.
Do you feel like with the situation that Pagano is in, with somebody as fast as Juan Pablo Montoya, obviously Will Power, I mean, his talent speaks for itself, and, you know, you're looking at Helio Castroneves. Do you feel like Simon Pagano can come in and essentially rival these guys for the championship, or do you feel like maybe he's the low guy on the totem pole? Because there's a lot of talent, but there's also a lot of strong personalities over at the Team Penske camp.
I'm going to have to defer to a wild card option here because we really don't know. We really don't know what he's going to do in that car. Granted, he did very well with Schmidt Peterson, winning a few races here and there. But to be honest with you, he is a complete wild card. It's very difficult to say what he's going to do this year because he's never been in this kind of a position before. Now, after two or three races, I'd say, yeah, we'll have a lot clearer of an understanding of where he's going to be. But I'd say right now, sure, he would be low man on the totem pole, but that's because there's no results for him yet in a Penske car. But I'd say after the New Orleans race and after Long Beach, we'll have a lot more information to draw our opinions from.
Well, it sure is going to be a lot of fun to watch. That can be certain. I mean, you got Simon Pagano, who's for sure wanting to outrun his teammates, but also his former team at Schmidt-Peterson, who now his car taken over by James Hinchcliffe, who's in turn going to want to outrun Pagano to prove that he's got more talent, who in turn is also going to want to outrun all of his former teammates over at the Andretti Autosport camp. So it's going to be a lot of fun early on, to be sure, not to mention the entire season. I want to get a chance to introduce the guest of the evening, Matt Weaver. How are you doing tonight?
Well, you guys are over here talking about how is Simon Pagano going to interact with his new teammates, you know, Will Power and Helio. And, you know, the only thing that's on my mind is how is this going to work? Because now you guys are introducing the real wild card of this entire conversation, Matt Weaver. And how is Matt Weaver going to interact and coexist with Barnes, Farmer, and Hardy? That is the question.
Well, given social media post earlier today with the big wildfires, your environment is the more wild card here, because we'll say Blaine Weaver's spreading to not just rain but the fire as well. So we really need to look out for you at the racetrack.
Well, Chris, you know, we're turning the page on 2014. You know, we've ended that era. It was a good year. I brought widespread torrential downpours, not only to a large majority of the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series schedule. I was able to do the same thing, work wonders for the IndyCar Series, for the Southern Super Series, the CRA Super Series, the Pro All-Star Series. It was a precipitation world tour. But this year, everything's changed. It's 2015. We're turning the page. We're flipping the script. This year, we're moving from rain to fire.
I'm not sure I pick fire over rain,
a canceled race for rain or a canceled race because fire's next to the track, I don't want to relive the 1998 Pepsi 400. Oh, goodness.
That rescheduling threw a wrench into that championship, having two plate races back-to-back.
Well, I'll say, Matt, right before you jumped on with us, we were talking a little bit about the IndyCar season, the testing that went on at NOLA, as well as we were gearing up to talk a little bit about this Brasilia situation. And, you know, I'll hand it to you. You have the floor. I'd love to get your thoughts on not just what you expect for the upcoming season, but, you know, this disaster that is Brazil. It just seems like IndyCar continues to fall flat on its face, and we're trying so hard to have hope, and we're clinging to that last string to watch them just rise up, and they just continue to, I guess, sit and wait like the rest of us.
Well, you said that you guys were talking about the IndyCar season, and I failed to realize that there even was an IndyCar season, much less an IndyCar. I think at a certain point, the IndyCar series has become out of sight and out of mind. I think this whole seven-month off-season situation has certainly backfired against them, and it was adding insult to injury when Brasilia, of course, canceled that race. And look, I'm not going to pretend to know all the details, but IndyCar going pretty much away and going into hibernation for the winter turned my attention to the NASCAR work and the short track work, so I'm not totally up to speed with what happened in Brazil. But I will say this, it seems very similar to what happened in Qingdao a few years ago in that, you know, you promised fans, you promised teams, you promised everyone involved in the sport or interested in the sport this race, and it seems like you really did not collect the check before announcing it, and you're waiting until the last minute to call off the festivities. And, you know, I've often compared IndyCar to Murphy's Law, the series, is what it is. Everything that will go wrong has gone wrong. And look, we all know that when things are going right in IndyCar, it is a fantastic racing product. And even with the fantastic racing product that we've had the past couple of years, as Derek Walker himself told us at Texas Motor Speedway over the summer, some Muppet came along and sent them in a new direction with AeroKit. So it just seems like, you know, IndyCar had a good formula going there a couple of years. Under Randy Bernard, you had schedule parity and an equalness between ovals and non-ovals. You had a pretty good roster. You had multiple teams involved in the sport. And, you know, to sum this all up and to tie it under a tidy little bow, I do not like the current direction of IndyCar. And I'm not entirely sure how to go. You've got a schedule that is largely road courses. You've now eliminated a large number of ovals, a large number of your street courses, which have been some of your better races here in the past couple of years. All your smaller teams have either banded together to form larger teams or gone away. 70% of the driver roster is comprised of your big three teams in Ganassi, Penske, and Andretti, and we're canceling races left and right. And so it's just not a good time to be invested in the Verizon IndyCar Series.
You know, you bring up a good point on, you know, the relevance of the series as far as you've pretty much forgotten about IndyCar. I believe it was John Oriovich of ESPN.com, and he made a reference to NASCAR in the most recent last few 22 months, actually. It's been relevant for 20 months of the 22. You look at IndyCar, it's been relevant for 10 of the 22. And if you look at the way society is going and we're all into this social media, got to have it now type of mentality, and if it's not now, it's not current. And if it's not current, nobody cares. And essentially, do you believe that maybe that's part of the problem on why IndyCar has become irrelevant? Because I know a lot of the drivers would love to see a season start in March into November, you know, be off for 4.5 months. And, I mean, there's many drivers on that, and spread out a little bit of what we've got with this crunch in the summer. So
there's a delicate balance to be had. I think there is a large contingent of people who work within NASCAR or who are supporters of NASCAR who would argue that their season is too long. I am not one of them. I think if you can sustain a long season from February to November, that's keeping people employed, that's keeping people working, that's keeping people talking about the sport. So I will never fuss about a sport that is, quote-unquote, too long, because that just tells me that the sport is at least sustainable. Meanwhile, IndyCar has shortened its schedule. It has lengthened its off-season. Because they've had to cancel races like Brasilia, and they weren't able to put a deal together to run in the Middle East, many teams are having to cut employees off of their staff and turn them into seasonal workers. And so when you just look at the entire outlook for IndyCar right now, it's just a struggle. And you talk about the relevancy factor. It's not just the schedule. It's not just the inflection of the schedule itself. It's not how many races there are. It's just, and IndyCar, I think, will be the first one to admit this, Mark Miles and company, that over the past half decade, and really longer than that too, but really under this merged IndyCar era, the sport has really struggled to market itself beyond its current fan base. And that's why they brought in Fry and O'Donnell last spring to oversee this new marketing arm to try to get partners involved and to activate drivers and to get their faces in more grocery stores and on products and on RC Cola and DHL trucks or what have you. IndyCar, I think, definitely recognizes that outside of its hardcore constituency, no one recognizes the drivers. And look, say what you will about NASCAR, there is a very serious case that could be made that even if you're not a racing fan, even if you're not a NASCAR fan, you recognize Dale Jr., you recognize Jeff Gordon, you recognize Jimmy Johnson, because they've reinvented their industry. And that's something that IndyCar really needs to find some way, and look, I don't have the answer, so I'm not criticizing IndyCar, but marketing isn't my forte either. But they need to find some way to take the Indy 500, because it's their biggest audience of the year, and find some way to turn that into a star-generating machine. Because last year, you know, I was there, and many of us watched the race. The biggest star of the Indianapolis 500 was the NASCAR driver who immediately left after the race to go back to stock car racing, and that's really unacceptable.
Yeah, well, I'll pick it up from here. I do agree with a lot of what you said, Weaver, about how the IndyCar's marketing sucks. But you know, and then kind of like what you talked about in this merged era of, you know, when IRL and Champ Car merged, it's like, you know, can you honestly say things are better now? I mean, 2008, we had, you know, we had big sponsors. We had Marlboro, which obviously left because of the MSA, but we had McDonald's at Newman Haas, we had Motorola at Andretti, we had 7-Eleven at Andretti, we had two Target cars, which one Target car is still there, but then every race was on ESPN or ABC. Where now, you know, we've got the big teams all as sponsors, but the rest of the teams are struggling to get sponsors. And, you know, and we have all of our races on NBCSN, which is still struggling. I mean, the ratings are probably going to go up a little bit this year now that NASCAR's on it. I mean, at least, you know, the two aren't really stepping on each other's toes too much. But it's like heading into this year, you know, Adam said multiple times we're excited about the aero kits, but IndyCar is not doing anything to get the fans excited about aero kits. I mean, they're not planning any kind of formal launch or anything like that. I mean, pretty much when the fans are probably going to see them when they roll off the trailers at Barber in a couple weeks. So everything with Brasilia, IndyCar didn't really do much to quell the speculation. I mean, Marcel Pruitt said that going to COTA was a possibility, but you know, common sense tells you, yeah, I think, you know, all four of us would love to see IndyCar at COTA, but IndyCar throwing together a race that quickly, you know, and if IndyCar was to rent the track, they would assume all liability to try to promote the race. And even if they partnered with the Pirelli World Challenge, it wouldn't be the headliner event. And then they talked about, you know, possibly extending the season an extra week to have the finale at Laguna Seca. But, you know, do we really see that happening? Having the season finale at Laguna Seca, 150 miles away from Sonoma in 2 weeks. I mean, that's a little bit of oversaturation. So, and then with Brasilia. I mean, Brasilia seemed to be. I kind of initially thought this it was a little different than other international races. I mean, China's another story. You know, it kind of goes. I mean, that wasn't Randy's fault on that. That was, the race was already set, and Tony Yours had already penciled in, but then once he got the boot and they brought Randy in, Randy took over the negotiations. But back on Brazil, it's, you know, initially it's like Brazil was you know, I mean, it seemed like it was political issues, but now they reported that that the government has finally released released $7 million to complete the track surface, so the track can be used. So it's like, you know, why would they cut the IndyCar deal and stop the money from flowing to the company building the track to just to then a week later changing their mind and wanting to finish the track again. So, you know, maybe Brazil saw something in IndyCar. I don't know, but I mean, it's just overall. I mean, heading into this season, they're not really doing much to promote the aero kits. But I mean, at this point, I'm not surprised. And the problems with IndyCar are beyond what meets the eye, and it's, you know, a lesson in how those people would be an honors course in university. So Chris, I'll let you have the floor now.
Well, another thing that about Brasilia, I think we should all know, is that the reason why they're finishing up the track services is so that locals can actually go back to using the track. But you mentioned
right.
2008. What else happened in 2008 was a big financial crisis hit in the later part of the year after everybody already put up their budgets for 2008. And, of course, that caused a big squeeze for a lot of people, especially racing sponsorships.
True.
With teams going in and going out. But then again, what was it, Fast, Tagliani's team started up, but it all depends, of course, on the fact that he got his equipment from Marty Roth. What's also, now I remember that, sorry about that, with McDonald's and everything like that being on Graham Rahal's car with Newman Haas Racing, they basically were on there as a favor to Paul Newman, because Newman's own the organic salad dressing was actually given out in the McDonald's restaurant, I think it was, or something else like that. It was a big corporate partnership kind of thing. But still,
yeah.
the business kind of thing was really what helped out, you know, CARB back in the 90s. And it's kind of thing that needs to take place again today. But how do I do it? I'm not the person that's going to be able to answer that question, unfortunately. Another thing that we also have to look forward to, I'm going to just chime in on this for a couple more minutes here, or maybe just one more minute. The Cooper Tires Winterfest is coming up for the Mazda Road to Indy over here at NOLA Motorsports Park on the 18th, 19th, and 20th. And actually, Jacob Edson was recently signed to drive in USF 2000 for the Winterfest. It looks like he was third place in the championship last year, so we'll see if he can get another shot at the title, if he can do well in Winterfest. There's going to be 3 Pro Mazda races, 3 USF 2000 races, and Indy Lights testing. So it'll be good to see the new Indy Lights car in person at NOLA Motorsports Park. Joey?
Yeah, for sure on that one. I think, you know, with Indy, it's going to be – there are so many questions to be answered, so many questions to be had. And I know that, you know, when questions get answered, 9 times out of 10, there's just more questions waiting to be answered. So we'll wait and see. We'll continue to wait, and
One thing that I would like to see IndyCar maybe possibly explore is one-day shows. I would love for them to be able to go to a place like Chicagoland or Kentucky, because it's proximity to Indianapolis, and show up early on a Saturday morning and get your practice time in, to qualifying in and race that night and go home. And in doing that, you can cut these tracks a bit of a sanctioning break. You're cutting your expenses for not having to stay, and you're back home in one day. That's the tried and true short track method. And sometimes we get away from that too, having 2 or 3 day shows, and you know, there's really no sense in it. And I know that the track's response has always been, well, we need to have multiple days to maximize our value. But I think of an event weekend like at Iowa, like me and you had went to last year, Chris, where you had the Truck Series race on Friday and the IndyCar race on Saturday. I like that model, but let's take it another step further. If you look at the crowds that day, and I know you did a little bit too, there were two distinctively different crowds that showed up on Friday and Saturday. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of carryover between fans of the NASCAR Camping World Truck Series and fans of the Verizon IndyCar Series. So if there are two distinctly different fan bases that are showing up anyway, then let's not bother having the IndyCar guys show up. Let's have them come in early on in the morning at Iowa, so they're a quick little drive relatively from Indianapolis, and make that a one-day show. One-day shows for both. That would help the Truck Series. That would help the IndyCar Series. Cut tracks like that, a sanctioning break, and see if that could be a way we can restore a little bit of balance with the schedule and getting some of these tracks that I know all of us want to see them go back to.
You know, the first track that comes to mind when I think about something like that is used to be a classic on the IndyCar calendar, but Phoenix, which I know there have been talks and whatnot, but at the end of the day, you know, the track wants to say, well, we need multiple days. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you don't have a show, you're not going to bring the people. And I think there's something to be said for that, because to some degree, it's almost as if these tracks, you know, and I understand that it's both parties here, but it's almost as if the tracks hold so much leverage when, in all honesty, there should be more give and take between the two. But, you know, it's business. It is what it is, I guess, at the end of the day.
For the sake of this practice, Phoenix is too far. I specifically mentioned Iowa, Kentucky, and Chicago just because of the proximity to Indianapolis. We're trying to find a way to cut the teams a break. You know, in many ways, let's look at how NASCAR grew to its current state of popularity and prominence. In its earliest days, it was still growing. That was a new league. And make no mistake, the current IndyCar is very much a new league at its current state. NASCAR pretty much stayed close to its North Carolina base. A large number of the tracks, Wilkesboro, Rockingham, Martinsville, Charlotte, all these tracks are right there in the backyard, and you really cut down on your expenses through not having to travel, not having to stay overnight. A lot of those early races were one-day shows. You came out early in the morning, you got all your practice time in, you got all your qualifying time in, and then you raced at night, and then you went back home. And, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but if you do it a couple of times a year, you do it for Kentucky, you do it at Illinois, you do it at Iowa, and you add that up, you've got three additional races, and each one of those races costs considerably less than a three-day show at Texas or a two-day show in St. Petersburg or wherever else you want to look at.
The only thing is, yeah, not every single team, of course, is based at the Indianapolis area. One thing with NASCAR is that a lot of teams are based in Charlotte because Holman Moody was there and they didn't want to deliver from parts, really. So just, well, we also have to remember that Foyt is based really in Houston, but they do have a second shop in Indianapolis that they're staffing up. Penske's got all the stuff in North Carolina.
Who cares?
Oh, yeah, of course. But Dale Coyne is over in Chicago as well, so they have to leave a little bit earlier. So it would be beneficial for most of the teams, just not for necessarily everybody. But, I mean, there's workarounds for that. Logistics is always a high-paying business that they can always hire people for that.
Yeah, that's not part of the problem?
Do what?
Is that not part of the problem?
Logistics?
Yes.
Well, you could argue that.
You could argue that. But I mean, I do like your idea of a one day show, especially when there's no sports series. I mean, when I was at Fontana, you know, I mean, the crowd at Fontana for the race, it was awful, and that was because Mark Miles told them to move to Labor Day because the Boston Consulting Group told them to. But Friday it was even worse. That they didn't even open up the main grandstands on Friday for practice because they didn't want to have to clean it. So they just gave everybody infield passes. I mean, that's where, you know, Fontana, they could easily, you know, practice at 9 o'clock in the morning. They could qualify at one, have a quick happy hour, and then start the race at night. I think that could work. And I mean, unless if the weekend was to get bigger again and they have more support series. I mean, I don't think that IndyCar should really leverage Pirelli World Challenge or what's left of Trans Am to go run the road for it, Pirelli World Challenge, then they're going to look at IndyCar like what are we? Are we here to save your series? No, they're not going to do anything. And plus, I don't think they have any desire to run on Rovals. I think the era of Roval racing has kind of come to an end. I mean, look, Tudor only runs Daytona now. It's a Roval. So.
Well, we're going to close out this what turned into a very eventful IndyCar segment, that's for sure. Matt Weaver,
always eventful.
Wild card. We're getting ready to, you know, it's February, guys. And even though there's some IndyCar stuff to be had, and it's about a month and a half away, give or take, you know, we got racing. We got speed weeks, and it's Daytona, and it's my second favorite time of the year next to Memorial Day weekend. You have the triple, but this is a beautiful 2 weeks setting up, and I know Matt Weaver, that's where you're heading down to right now. And today was media day. We're gearing up for an unlimited. Then Daytona 500 qualifying. There's all sorts of short track stuff, ARCA stuff, everything going on in between. You know, what are you looking for as you get ready for the speed weeks?
Well, for one, I'm just looking forward to racing. It's good to be finally talking about you know, high horsepower, high speed racing. You know, we have our short track races that we do a lot of during the winter, Snowball Derby, DRA Speedfest, but as much as I'm in favor of more short track racing, I admit that there is nothing like the sound of high-powered stock cars rolling around Daytona International Speedway in February. And, you know, I'm just excited to get back down there for the next 2 weeks and, you know, get back to the follow-up to what was a very wild 2014 NASCAR season.
No, absolutely. You know, we're getting ready for the Unlimited up here, and you know, you got Kevin Harvick, defending champion. You know, for me personally, I'm looking to see if there's the championship hangover effect. And you know, he's a three-time winner of the event, and we got some other nice storylines kind of leading into this event, obviously with Jeff Gordon, and then, you know, with this being his last year, not to mention seeing what Danica Patrick can do in her third full season at the cup level. And you know, as far as Saturday night goes, it's kind of interesting that we saw four guys withdraw their entry into this race, just given the fact that it's time on the track. It's you know, and I understand you don't want to wreck your primary car and mess it up for the 500, but you know, there's no substitute for track time. So I was a little surprised at this, and I know that Ricky Stenhouse Jr. replaced. I forget who it is off the top of my head. But, you know, talking a little bit about these four entries that withdrew, are you a little surprised by that?
Matt?
Oh, he said here he's back now. Well, I mean, I'm kind of, I mean, I'll go ahead and jump in on this. I mean, I remember Allmendinger said that, you know, they didn't know they were going to be in the bud shootout or Sprint Unlimited. My apologies, I'm still an old school guy, but you know, they didn't have sponsorship to run it, and you know, just to run it, you know, run it for a show. I guess it you know, you know, every team's got their own agenda. So Matt, I mean, you're back, and the question was, were you surprised to see the four guys withdraw from the Sprint Unlimited?
I think there's still a little bit of issues on that one.
Well, one thing that I need to just go back on you on with Joey is that the teams do not run their Daytona 500 cars, their primary cars, in the Sprint Unlimited. They're more than likely to run their backup cars in that race for one big reason. Of course, they spend a lot of time prepping and, you know, shining up and, you know, doing all the aero tricks in their big primary cars. Really what they're looking at is this, more like the stuff underneath the bodywork. To really modify, but of course there is no substitute for track time, like you said.
I was actually looking at it more from a setup perspective. I mean, when you're looking at
exactly,
you know, the rear springs and air pressure and things like that, I just from a crew chief perspective, from a car chief perspective, I mean, that's 75 extra laps or whatever it is. you know, out on track that you don't, yeah, you got a ton of practice time because of speed weeks, but at the same time, I mean, everything is set up the way it is, so you're just kind of hoping, if I'm a driver, I want in.
Well, let me kind of jump in on this. I think right now, with the way that these teams and these cars are in a box for Daytona and speed weeks, there's really not a lot to be learned in this race. Also, keep in mind that this is the same package from last year. There is nothing that has changed in these cars from last year to this year. In fact, the car that Eric Almirola will be driving on Saturday night is actually the car that he took to Victory Lane here in July. So, you know, it's, you got to talk about setups and trying to learn something, and there's no substitute for track time. You know, that's not necessarily the case from an engineering perspective. I think for the drivers who are in the Unlimited, there's a benefit from just learning the draft again, because remember, with the testing ban, there was no preseason thunder this year. So this will be the first time that drivers are on the track in a restricted plate setting since last year at Talladega, and the first time at Daytona since July. So that was the primary benefit for those in the Unlimited.
Well, we're getting ready for also the 500, but before any of that kicks off, there's some cool cats over in the ARCA race, and I know that that's something that you and I had a chance to talk a little bit about last night. You know, this is a nice little lineup that ARCA's got for this race. So, you know, who do you like? What kind of things are you going to be watching for? And because some of these guys are guys that you've watched short track racing, and, you know, they're trying to make it to the next level, and it's just one step closer.
Well, you know, everyone talks about the Sprint Unlimited, and they talk about it as the main event and the big deal of Saturday. And certainly, make no mistake, it is a very fun show, and it's a show that I look forward to more than many others for very many different reasons. But to me, personally, my main event on Saturday is the ARCA race. It's a race that actually does mean something as far as a championship and learning some things, and more so, the ARCA package right now is a little less random. You know, you still have a little bit of bits parity. Everyone talks about parity as something that racing theory should aspire to, but I think sometimes parity in NASCAR actually hurts their product, and that's not the case with the ARCA series. You know who your favorites are, and that creates underdogs, more so than in NASCAR, where there's really no one truly an underdog in those racing than in the 500. But, yeah, the roster for this race is just really interesting. You kind of teased it a little bit, but Daniel Hemric will be making his debut at Daytona. In order to run Truck Series race next Friday night, he has to run the ARCA race. He's running for NTS Motorsports. This is one of the more popular and beloved and successful short track drivers over the past couple of years. He was our Southern Super Series champion back in 2013, the winner of the Legends Million at Charlotte Motor Speedway. He won the Red Bud 300 at Anderson Motor Speedway in Indiana. So, you know, a really talented guy, and someone who the perception always was, well, yeah, he's really good, but in order to do this, he's going to have to bring a check. And, you know, they worked really hard to find some partners and sponsors, and they were able to get some help from the Dillons, who Hemric has a good relationship with, and now they have this package put together, and he's going to go truck racing. So certainly that's the one name that I'm looking forward to watching, just because I've seen Daniel race for so many years. But then you just go down the roster, and you've got the defending ARCA Series champion, Mason Mitchell, who still hasn't finalized his Truck Series endeavors for this year. And so he's going to run ARCA and possibly more races after Daytona. And so some of the Truck Series stuff can materialize. You got Grant Enkinger, who yet another guy that I actually raced with myself back in the day. In fact, I've raced against both Grant Enkinger and Thomas Moose Prater, so there's a built-in relationship there. You have international stars and a good mixture of drivers from all over, different backgrounds. So it's a fun race.
Matt, you mentioned that there were no underdogs in NASCAR. There is one big underdog in NASCAR, but you're not pronouncing it right. It's under Doge, as in Dogecoin, as in Josh Wise. That's the real under Doge of NASCAR. But back to Daniel Hemric, I had to do it. I'm sorry, guys. But back to Daniel Hemric, he had his truck race debut, his big speedway debut at Homestead last year in the final race of the season. You said that, you know, he had a lot of fun doing it, but he basically figured it out later on in the race, how to run it. Do you know if, this is actually a genuine curiosity for me, do you know if he's had any kind of speedway testing at all of any kind over the end of off season? Because I'm honestly curious to see how well he does in the truck series at Daytona and for the rest of the year, and also in ARCA as well.
Well, I've got to speak with Daniel first thing in the morning. He's actually the first guy that I'm going to go track down once I get to the speedway. But I can tell you that he has had zero experience beyond what he enjoyed at Homestead. And we all saw that race. You know, he qualified good by himself. The truck had good power at NTS Motorsports, but he said there was nothing that compared to restarts in the big pack, going into turn one, and just all the different clash of air that was fighting around his car. And he admitted that he did not figure it out until about 20 laps to go, and you know, the results show it. Joey was there with me, and we watched him climb about 20th, which is where he had fallen back to, with about 20 laps to go, and he climbed his way up to 12th by the end of the race, and he came over the radio and told his spotter, Tim Fedewa, the old Busch Series driver, told Tim, you know, I just now got it figured out. Can we start over? Can we do this again? Because he had never tested a truck until he got to the first practice session of the day at Homestead, and that was his first track action, and because of the testing ban, he has not been able to get any more track time either, to my knowledge. Now, NASCAR does allow certain exceptions for rookie drivers, and I don't know if Daniel would classify, but my immediate answer is no. He's had no experience beyond Homestead.
Well, I know we certainly wish him the best of luck. Josh, what did you have?
Well, I wanted to kind of get y'all's opinion like we were saying, you know, I think the ARCA race is definitely the compelling show of Saturday. But actually, I have two things. Number one, on the ARCA race, I think this race has kind of shaken its stigma away from being, I remember reading in Ryan Newman's book, it was labeled as the Blood Plasma 200, and just from the tendency of the very, very bad wrecks, and then you would only have, you know, you would only have four or five cars, and a lot of them were cuff-backed teams, you know, they would put their younger driver in, and then you'd have the top ARCA team fighting it with them. That this race has kind of shaken off that stigma and taken on its own identity to being one of the best in speed weeks. And another thing on the Sprint Unlimited, you know, with how they've, you know, the last couple of years they had the format, as you know, they went back to the traditional Bud Shootout format of pole winners from the past few years, but now they changed it to all the chasers, and I don't even know what the rest of it is now. But I mean, do you think that the race is in a way kind of losing its relevance per se?
Oh, Farmer, you're going to get me on a rant that we don't have enough time to go all the way through. But short answer on the ARCA race, I think the past couple of years has really changed the perception of that race. You haven't seen a lot of the stupid accidents anymore. It's a very professional field, a lot of experience. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of shenanigans, because if you look at NASCAR as a whole, the development system has started to take less check and start to value talent a little bit more. And that could be the economy improving to where talented drivers like Hemric can get in a little bit more easier and find backing a little bit more easily. So I think we're going to see a very clean race, a very professional race. Now, as for the Unlimited, I think right now there is so much wrong with the Sprint Unlimited. And I think the Sprint Unlimited is a snapshot of many of the things that are wrong with the current NASCAR product altogether. I think right now NASCAR is on this kick to where we need to include everybody in everything. Otherwise, people are going to tune out. We need to have 16 drivers of the 26 that compete full-time in the playoffs, which is absolutely absurd. We need to have everyone who made the chase, everyone who won a pole, everyone named Danica Patrick, everyone named Dale Jr. in the Sprint Unlimited, because if those guys aren't in the race, fans are not going to watch. And this whole all-inclusive mentality, I think, is really to the detriment long-term of the product, because everything loses meaning and everything loses value. And I think it actually hurts the racing, too. Let me take you guys back in time a little bit. That's firing up the hot tub time machine, and not too far either, just to last year. At the end of the Sprint Unlimited last year, when that race started at 18 cars, I believe, and we only had about eight running at the finish of that race. So there was no longer big pack racing. You had guys who were spread out doing the slingshot. It looked like 2011 at Indianapolis all over again. That was some of the best racing I have seen at Daytona in a long time. It was very reminiscent to what we used to have back in the old days, the Bud Shootout, when you only had pole winners and you had fields of 10 and 11 drivers. Yeah, not everyone was involved, and there was a certain risk involved that maybe the two fans of Ricky Stenhouse Jr. may not tune in. But I think you had a much better show. I think the race felt elite, and it felt like truly this was a star-studded race. But, you know, the Unlimited is a perfect name for it because, you know, we're going to allow everyone in. Breaking news, I declined to participate in the Sprint Unlimited, and the sport's better off for it.
Well, you mentioned Danica Patrick. One of the rules changes they made for eligibility was all former Daytona 500 pole winners, of which she's eligible because she won the pole for the 500 back in 2013.
That was I smell black Danica helicopters rule. On that one. I smell black helicopters on that one.
Well, yeah, because that gets Danica and it gets Austin in future years. They decide to maintain this trend. They want Danica in and they want the number three in.
Yeah, if they're gonna do that, then they may as well call up Ken Schrader and every other pollster in the Daytona 500 in the last 30 years have a legends race.
Yeah.
Actually, that would probably be more fun than watching the Unlimited. To be honest with you, I mean, Ken Schrader going around a lot of fun. Period.
You mentioned underdogs, by the way, Weaver, earlier. Another underdog, just throw out your window. How can we possibly forget former ARCA Daytona winner John West Townley?
Oh, God.
Because he has an ARCA win there. Don't forget.
Yeah.
thanks to Bobby Gearhart running out of gas on the back stretch, only a few laps to go. I remember watching that race thinking, oh, man, he's coming up on traffic. He's gonna mess it up. There's going to be a crash here with the last two laps of the race. And, no, he was able to go to victory lane. And, of course, NASCAR cut the coverage to go right to whoever the name of the guys are that talk on Speed Channel 3 hours before the race, before the Sprint Unlimited. And we never got to see his post-race interview until an hour and a half later. How could we possibly forget that day?
I can't drink enough to forget what you just said. Oh, my goodness. You know,
Chris, we were all screaming at the TV when we saw that.
Goodness gracious. I can't believe what I just heard. My gosh.
If I may, one more thing about John West Townley, if I may. I know I'm going on a rant here, but if NASCAR gave away points for personal hygiene, he would be a Sprint Cup champion because I saw him before the Iowa truck race. I've never seen anybody floss their teeth so meticulously in my life.
Oh, dear.
There is no one who spends more time on his hair, both getting into a car when he's about to put on a helmet, and then taking the helmet off before getting outside to talk to whoever wants to talk to the driver who finished 24th place. We got to love John West. I love his personality. I think he's great for the sport. And, you know, call me crazy, but at 24 years old, I think there's room for an improvement. But John West was a character, and, you know, there is no one who is more manicured and well-prepared than John West.
Yeah, well, I think Alex Bowicki also combed his hair quite meticulously, and Bill Elliott gave him a golden comb.
Oh, this show is falling off the wheel.
Blame Weaver.
on Weaver's point, outside of the blame Weaver point, you know, I want to touch a little bit on the Unlimited thing that you just mentioned. To me, you know, watching it, you know, well before I got a chance to get into it as a media member, as a journalist, and see that side of the sport, you know, watching what this event has become from what it was, I feel like it's really lost a lot of its prestige. And to me, I'm a person that really values tradition. I really think that it's always important to be embedded in your roots, no matter how much you venture out as a sport or as a team or anything else. And I really feel like they've gotten away from what this race really was. It was not supposed to be clamored as this event where, like you said, everybody's welcome. I mean, I'll go fire up my car right now and step on the track and get in the Sprint Unlimited. It's just, there's a bit of it that I feel the traditional fan or the longtime fan, I don't want to speak for them, but speaking for myself, I can't stand it. So I don't even know. I more or less look forward to, like you said, the ARCA race. I like you, look forward to that. I look forward, actually, more than anything, to the qualifying. I love seeing the cars all trimmed out, and I love seeing who's got the all-natural speed. I love seeing the elements, even though people will say, well, it's 2.5 hours of a car going doing solo runs around the track. Look, that is some of the most awesome, just not only just luck of the draw, literally draw with where you go in the qualifying order, but what the crew chiefs can do. I love that aspect of the sport, and I love to see how everything's setting up, because all I love to do is debate what's going to happen leading up to the duels on Thursday. So,
I hate to break it to you, but you know there's group qualifying for the Daytona 500 on Sunday.
That's right. Yes.
Not only are we having group qualifying, we are also having the same group qualifying format from Talladega in the fall. All the teams completely goofed up on and sent Justin Allgaier and Ricky Stenhouse Jr. home for not getting in a full, fast, timed lap.
This should be fun. Somebody's going to get
it. Can you explain how exactly the team goofed that up? Because, I mean, it's still spellbinding to me this day.
You know, what happened there was is that we have seen that format used initially for the then Nationwide Series, the Xfinity Series, the Truck Series at Daytona. Then we saw the Cup Series use it at Talladega and Daytona. And what happened was that you had it set up to where you had all this time, you had 30 minutes of that first round, and teams would just sit there and wait until 3-4 minutes to go, and then they pull out. And, of course, to get a fast lap, you have to draft. So no one wants to be the first guy out. So then it became this grand posturing game where you would try to spike out your competitor to be the first one in line. So NASCAR's theory was, we're going to eliminate the pretext. We're going to just cut these rounds into 10-minute blocks, 5-minute blocks, and you've got to go. Well, the teams managed to overthink it anyway, and they did the same thing. It was the posturing, the waiting, and finally the teams looked at their watches, or they looked at their phone, their iPods, and they realized, oh, crap, we need to go right now. And several things happened. Whoever was out front did not get the fast lap in, and some drivers were not able to even get around in time to cross the line to get a full lap in because they waited to be at the back. So they couldn't even cross the line in time. So, you know, if it's left up to me, we do a draw for these restricted plate races. Because it doesn't matter where you start. It doesn't even matter where you start on qualifying, but you line them up by draw. If you draw number one, you're the first car at the pit stall. And when the NASCAR official shoots the gun, metaphorically, and says qualifying starts right now, all 40-whatever cars need to pull out concurrently together in unison, and if anyone doesn't go, then your time doesn't count. And that would completely eliminate the shenanigans right then and there. And if you want to be up front, if you want to be in the back or whatever, well, it's fine. You better do it on the track. And you better posture yourself that way as long as you meet the minimum speed. But this whole dilly-dally, shilly-shally of waiting around on pit road is just silly. It makes the sport look silly. Just go.
Yeah, we've got, give or take, about 10 minutes left before the conclusion of the show. And, you know, I know there's no, you and I know you're notorious for saying this to me. There's no sleepers at a restrictor plate race, Joey. But, you know, if you had to look at this and you're looking at, obviously everybody's a contender, but if you had to look at some guys that you really are going to keep an eye on that you think are going to potentially win, just off of sheer feel, off of kind of what your gut's telling you, we're getting ready for the 500. Who do you think is, A, more than likely going to be the guys you're going to watch at the end, or B, to that other bit, we got 50 cars that are going to try to make the show. Do you think we have any shockers at that end?
Well, the reason I tell you there are no such things as a surprise or a dark horse at Daytona, there's kind of a misnomer that we have one. And the only reason why there's this perception that we have misnomer, the perception that we have these dark horses, because it goes back to what I said about parity. And that right now NASCAR has situated itself to where everyone is so equal, meaning that if you look at the top 25 teams based on your point standings, or really the top 20 to be more fair, but you could make a case top 25, they're all part of a major team. When you add up the cars that drive for Hendrick, 4 cars, Phil Gibbs Racing, 4 cars, Stewart Haas Racing, 4 cars, Team Penske, 2 cars, Petty, which is aligned with Roush, which Roush has 3 cars, Petty 2 cars. But there's your 22, 23, 24 cars. So those are your favorites. Those are all your favorites. Your favorites all compose of your 2/3 of the field. So it's not a surprise when any of those guys win. Now, if there's someone who's not a part of that top 23, well, that would be a bit of a surprise. If you just look at purely based on the numbers, the chances are, based on numbers, if you were to do a random number generator, which I often do to pick the winner of these races, you're going to draw one of those top 33 numbers before you draw one of the bottom 13 numbers, just, again, based on math, 23, 13. My math is terrible. You get the idea. but if there are... certain guys that you would not expect. Again, I don't think there are certain guys you don't expect. It is not a surprise to me when Front Row Motorsports runs up closer to the front for these races because, again, everyone is equal. We saw last year at times that BK Racing could get a little racing in these events. Tommy Baldwin Racing always brings their A game for these plate races. The way that NASCAR is structured, these restricted plate races, no one's getting test time. No one's getting track time. So everyone is all equal. So, you know, if we had a scenario that plays out to where Alex Bowman in the TBR number 7 managed to win the Daytona 500, I would be like, hey, that's a cool story, and that's amazing, and who saw that happening? But would it completely shock me? Absolutely not, because right now we're so equal and we're so even. If you have the horsepower, you're going to do it. And right now, Toyota has a real good engine package. We saw that late in the year at during the chase. And certainly a team like BK Racing that I used as an example earlier has that sort of engine package. So, I mean, yeah, more than likely, I think you look at Hendrick and you look at Penske. My personal pick for the Daytona 500 this year is Brad Keselowski, just because if you look at the past 3 or 4 years, he's always running near the front. I think this is the year where he does it. But if Tommy Baldwin, BK type wins it, it would not shock me at all, just because everyone's so equal.
I'm gonna throw you 3 final questions, and we'll close out the show here shortly. First, I'm going to start with this. Brian Vickers can't run in the Daytona 500, and he's going to be replaced by MWR development driver Brett Moffitt. How do you feel he's going to do in that 55?
Well, it's a great opportunity for Moffitt at Atlanta the second week of the season. I'm a huge fan of Brett Moffitt, and I have been since I watched him race in the K&M Pro Series a couple of years ago. Brett is so well thought of by Toyota and by MWR that they had Jeff Burton under contract last year to do R&D and to be the test driver. And, you know, he did a great job there. He provided valuable feedback. Jeff understands these cars. But Jeff felt comfortable walking away from that job halfway in the season because he's kind of like, and he even told me this, he says, you guys have Brett. And Brett's feedback and what Brett has provided when he does R&D and when he drives the tough cars is, you know, pretty much on par with what I'm giving you. So I'm going to start transitioning to TV now, spend some time with my son Harrison, and yeah, I think you guys are going to be okay. And Michael agreed, and Toyota agreed, and they think very highly. Let me tell you another story about Brett Moffitt. This is how well-regarded he is. When he made his Cup debut at Dover last late spring, early summer, during driver introductions, when Brett was riding around on the Silverado pickup around the track, technology and stuff, when he came back down on pit road to get off the truck and take his place in the car, the Jay Robinson number 66, the crew, the MWR crew and the Jay Robinson crew applauded their driver because they were so proud of him being able to have this moment, making his Cup start. Everyone at MWR and Toyota is so supportive of Brett Moffitt, and I guarantee you he's going to have every resource available at Atlanta. I don't think this is going to be a scenario where it's like, well, Brian's not in the car, so you know, we don't like our chances, and we're going to kind of just take this weekend off. Not happening. They're going to give Brett every scenario possible. And the name that I keep hearing pop up in the garage and inside the media center is Jamie McMurray when he was substituting for Sterling Marlin in the Silver Bullet number 40 for Chip Ganassi Racing. And he goes out there and wins in his second start at Charlotte Motor Speedway. I think we could see a very similar deal where Brett Moffitt earns his place in the sport by going out there and maybe not winning, posting top five, top ten, leading laps at Atlanta Motor Speedway.
Jamie McMurray is exactly who came to my mind whenever you started talking about that. The next question of the three, do you expect Kevin Harvick to have a championship hangover, or do you expect him to come out swinging much like he left last year?
I think Kevin Harvick is going to have a very similar year. I think Kevin Harvick can exceed his win total. I think Kevin Harvick can exceed his top five and top ten total. You look at how many races Kevin could have won last year. I mean, we're talking about a guy who could have won 10 races last year, which is just silly. I think Kevin has that same sort of potential this year, and which you would think would automatically make him a lock for the championship. And this is the one thing I don't like about the new championship format. It's so random. And I think the right guy won last year. I think there's no doubt that Kevin Harvick in the number 14 was the best team, or at least the fastest team. I think you could look at the number 2 team, the number 24 team, and you know they could make claims on being the best team. But certainly, pound for pound, pure speed, the number 14 had it all year and kind of shot themselves in their foot a little bit. So they're going to do it again this year. But can they win the championship? Who knows? We saw what happened last year at Texas and Charlotte and Phoenix and Homestead. It's crazy. It's complete pandemonium. So he's got his hands full with winning this championship back-to-back seasons.
Man, that last half of the season was a lot of fun, though, wasn't it? Texas hanging out and that whole scenario coming up. And I mean, you and I were right there in the thick of it, and then also Homestead. I mean, that was just I would love to have been at Phoenix. That's probably the only thing I can say is I didn't quite make it to Phoenix, and I wish I could have. The last question on this little segment, you didn't pick your Saturday. You didn't have your Saturday picks. We're talking about the ARCA race and the Unlimited, and you know you got your little band there, Bandits in the ARCA race. So I would love to see. I'm going to make you square down and put your thumb down on one person. Who you got?
Well, I think we're going to see a Hollywood scenario take place on Saturday afternoon. I think Frank Kimmel, who has been trying for decades upon decades upon decades to win this race, finished second so many times, finished second last year, is finally going to win the Lucas Oil 200 at Daytona International Speedway. For this season, he has paired himself with Venturini Motorsports. It is the most prolific driver who's won the most championships in the history of the sport. And Frank Kimmel, pairing with Venturini Motorsports, who no one has had more success, no one has won more races by and large than Venturini. They're coming together for 10 races this year, starting at Daytona. And I think that the combination of Frank Kimmel at Daytona with Venturini Motorsports in the flagship number 25 is going to be awfully hard to beat. I think Frank finally gets it done. And, you know, there's some talk that Frank is trying to find another team to run the other 10 races and try to split the schedule and maybe chase the championship. But I'll tell you what, if he goes out there and wins Daytona, I seriously would not be surprised if he puts his foot down right there and says, all right, we're done. It's been a great career. I think he wins the ARCA race. The Unlimited, give me just a second here. I knew this question was coming, actually. So I had random.org pulled up on my phone, which is my go-to for picking restrictor plate races. First answer is 12. Now there's probably number 12 in the field. Second number is 24. Jeff Gordon is going to win the Sprint Unlimited in its final attempt to win the Unlimited.
That's some brilliant.
Everyone go to random.org. Pick your Daytona 500 winner here in a couple of weeks.
You know, I would personally love to see Frank Kimmel win. I watching ARCA a lot of years, and I've seen him try and try. And, you know, if that is the theme for the speed weeks, you know, my heart's got to be with Tony Stewart as far as trying to get the monkey off his back as well. I know Frank Kimmel's been racing at Daytona a hell of a lot longer, but, you know, if that's the precedence that's set, that would be a lot of fun to see a speed week complete that starts with Frank Kimmel and ends with Tony Stewart. You know, guys, Chris, I'll roll with you, and then we'll move over to Josh, and then close with Matt. But I'd love to get your, if y'all got any final thoughts, closing thoughts, before we end out the show.
Well, for Daytona, for the ARCA race, I would love to see, Frank Kimmel winning it. Daniel Hemric would be a great pick as well. But I believe I have my team of choice for the ARCA race. I don't know who's driving for them, but whoever's driving for Wayne Pearson Racing, because apparently their race shop is a two-car garage, and that's real racing is all hell right there. As for the Sprint Unlimited, I'll go with Brad Keselowski on that one for him winning, and I'll go ahead and give a random statistic. There was a NASCAR race in 1956 in the convertible division where everybody crashed out except for Curtis Turner, and he was declared the winner because nobody else was running. Josh, take it away. And that's a true story, by the way. Take it away, Josh.
Yeah, well, first off, before I get my picks, I just want to say I was watching the Media Day coverage, and I just got to say it's good to see Tony Stewart at least back to what the Tony Stewart that we've come to see. It's like he was joking with, I can't remember who asked the question, but it was like he said, what would it mean to win the Daytona 500 this year after so many years? And Tony said, well, it would feel the same as it would have been if I would have won it last year and the year before that and the year before that. So it's good to hear after Tony had such a crappy year last year. It's good to see him at obviously, like you say, he's never going to be 100% again, but it's at least to see he's doing better. But for the ARCA race, I'm thinking Hemric. You know, he's probably a good pick, but Bobby Gerhardt's always a great pick for these races. But for the buzz shootout, I'd say Harvick probably has a good shot to cap off another one. So Weaver, we'll let you close it out.
Yeah, absolutely. There are times where I'm accused of being a little bit of a curmudgeon, being the controversial Matt Weaver, as Bob Dillner introduced me at the Snowball Derby. And certainly, you know, I can be a bit of a rabble-rouser, but I just want to make something very clear on this show and all the time. Any time that I get fussy about racing or, you know, I give an unpopular opinion or I criticize the current direction of IndyCar and NASCAR when I feel like that's what I have to do, it's only because I truly and sincerely want the sport to be better and I have ideas. That's not to say I have all the right ideas. I think that everyone who has ideas coming to the table together and going back and forth and that sort of discourse is how we ultimately help our sport continue to grow. So there have been times where I've been accused of being a little too negative, and make no mistake, I love this sport, and I am so, so happy that, you know, the NASCAR and IndyCar and ARCA season and short track season is really about to ramp up, because there is nothing like motorsports live and in person, and I feel extremely blessed to be a part of it full time, and the chance to be able to talk with it with you guys is something I certainly do not take for granted. So thanks for having me on.
I'll say on behalf of all of us, it's a pleasure that you would want to come on the show. We definitely appreciate it. You know, folks, if you get a chance, go to Popular Speed, go to race22about.com. Matt Weaver's stuff is all over the place. He's got his hands in a little bit of every pot these days. And he's also, you can look him up at social media, Matt Weaver, SBN, at your local Twitter feed. So Scott always got some entertaining stuff, always on Twitter, every time I turn around. Matt, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate the time tonight and the picks, and we wish you well on your trips out there in Daytona.
Appreciate it.
Well, folks, as always, we're getting ready to close out the show. I want to thank you for joining us. And it's been a blast, it's been a pleasure, and we hope you stay tuned to Daytona, watch some ARCA, watch some short track stuff, go to your local short track and support that stuff, because these guys and girls are trying to scrap to get to the top level, so you can watch them every day on TV. And thank you for joining us on this edition of In the Gravel Trap, and we hope you have a good night. Forza Jules, good night, folks.